right, welcome. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that's Decisions. That's right, from Outer National. And decisions are what we all got to be chewing on and making more and more these days. They're very important as we go along. Every decision you make becomes all that much more important, all right, in the big picture of things. We have a really, really exciting show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing from Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we'll be hearing from his recent talk, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible." And we're going to hear his response to the question, how can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly, like immigrants and minorities? And how can we get them to be on the streets? Now, this has special importance right now, since the Supreme Court has just recently allowed Trump's entire Muslim ban to take effect. And before that, we'll be listening to, or we'll be talking with, Sam Menefee-Libby of the Dead City Legal Posse, and we'll be talking about defending the Inauguration Day protesters who are facing 60 years in prison in a vengeful attack on the right to protest. And we'll get an update from the first trial, which is now taking place. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring this to you. I had a discussion earlier today with Dr. Leroy Carhart, and Dr. Carhart is waging a battle to defend and protect the right of all women to have access to abortion. He's one of the very few courageous doctors to provide late-term abortions, and recently his clinic in Maryland was abruptly closed by the landlord, who announced that it had been bought up by anti-woman fascists. So without any further ado, let's just jump right into that. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my first guest. His name is Dr. Lee Carhart. And Dr. Carhart has been providing abortion care for over 45 years. And to further assist women, in 2000, Dr. Carhart and his wife, Mary Carhart, established a nonprofit organization, the Abortion Access Fund, Inc., which helps patients pay for abortion care through generous donations from across the U.S. It assists clinic owners in keeping their doors open and supports the opening of new clinics. Dr. Carhart's mission is to train future providers in advanced gestation abortion care to ensure abortion not only stays legal, but accessible in the decades to come. And this is a major, major challenge right now before all of us, basically to maintain what is a basic human right for women and is constantly being attacked. And by the way, you get an idea of what Dr. Carhart is all about if you check out the documentary, the 2013 documentary, After Tiller. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, definitely. I keep thinking about you every time I read the newspaper about something about abortion. I think, gotta call Lee. So I'm really glad we were able to hook up this time. Let's jump into it. You recently wrote an op-ed piece for Truthout, and you were pointing to a new escalation in the attacks on a woman's right to abortion. And you say that anti-abortion politicians are more brazen than ever under the Trump regime. What's happening? Give people a sense of what's happening.
You know, I mean, with the changes in the Department of Justice, with, you know, Sessions and the whole Republican, they're not enforcing some of the laws that used to be there, or in fact, the laws are still there. They're just taking less of an importance in enforcing them. But the main, you know, the main problem is right now, like this recent episode in Texas that I was talking about in that op-ed piece is, you know, to deny a woman that's incarcerated, a minor, and that's pregnant, and didn't want to be, and still doesn't want to be, yet they're going to keep her incarcerated. And she's also an illegal alien, and that's why she's incarcerated, not that she did anything else wrong. So they're going to make her have a child that, you know, they talk about they don't want anchor babies. Now they're forcing her to have one when she was willing to. Didn't want that to happen. I mean, it's just a continuation of the goal of old white rich men trying to control women. And, you know, no matter how you cut the abortion issue, that is the abortion issue.
It's pretty heavy, actually. You know, talk about this, too. Going beyond, you know, this individual case that you were talking about, you've written about as well that there's been an explosion of state-level restrictions since 2010. And this is fairly heavy because a lot of people have thought, okay, well, on one level, while yes, there's a fight to maintain and push forward the right of a woman to have an abortion when she wants one, and people may have thought that maybe things are easing up a little bit, but there's actually been a whole storm of an explosion of state-level restrictions over the last 10 years, 7 years. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, this year alone, Michael, in the current legislatures in the United States, there are 400 and 24 anti-choice legislative pieces that have been introduced. In the federal government, there have been 25. And this is not new this year. The number is new this year. Last year, it was like in the 300s, I believe. So, you know, only a few of them get through. But first of all, if you count the countless hours that the politicians spend debating these issues, you know, it makes it understandable why nothing that's really important in this country gets done, because the people that can control the Congresses or the Houses and the Senates of the states, or the unicameral in my state, they prevent the important legislation from ever getting to the floor by tying up days in committee work. It's just a total waste of time, not even to look into the fact that everything that they're proposing is really an assault on women's health care. I mean, abortion is health care, and health care is a human right, and abortion is a human right. It's just, you have to draw that line. The anti say, oh, well, we just want to eliminate the late-term abortion because, you know, nobody likes late-term abortion. But if you ask any of the leaders of the anti-choice what they consider late-term, and that's the day after conception. So that's what they're trying to eliminate.
Now, one of the things that happens, too, though, is that there are people like yourself who actually say, to hell with that, and you're going to stand up against that. And you have never stopped actually providing abortions for women when you've been able to do that, when women have needed and when you've been able to do that. And now they have a new thing that's coming up where they're talking about, what is it called, a 20-week ban? And under that, I understand that not only is that, you know, the attack on women, but it's also for people like yourself. That could mean if you continue to stay true to your principles and provide abortions for women, that could actually mean a jail sentence for you.
Oh, absolutely, it could. You know, that's been their goal. In Nebraska, we had a clinic, and, you know, hindsight is 2020, and maybe we didn't handle it right. Maybe we should have challenged the 20-week ban in Nebraska. But now it's in, I think, 26 states or something like that. And, of course, the federal government's toying with the issue. And if it passes, it'll get tied up in the courts for 2 or 3 years, hopefully long enough to get somebody in Washington that has a little bit of empathy for women's issues, and we can avert the disaster. But I think, you know, it all comes down to one thing. And until women will get out and demand what's their choice, it's not going to happen. Doctors can't cause it to happen. Politicians can't cause it to happen unless the women of this country put them there. And they've been putting them there. And it's time that the women wake up and say, enough is enough. We need to have people that believe in choice, and then we'll worry about what their other issues are.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Lee Carhart. Lee has been providing abortion care for over 45 years and has been right in the middle of the assault on abortion and the fight to defend abortion rights and the humanity of women everywhere. Yeah, you know, one thing I think, too, though, and I would agree with that, except I also would say, hey, there's got to be a lot more people like you, not just abortion providers, but also men who will stand up and say, this is a woman's basic fundamental human right to have an abortion, and it should not be toyed with. It should not be, you know, turned into a crime. And one of the things I kept thinking about as I was reading about, you know, reading some of the things that you've written, some of the stuff that's been happening, that there is actually a kind of steamroller. And there's a lot of steamrolling moves that oftentimes when you see what's happening, when they're just plowing through all the stuff that's been, you know, advances that have been made in terms of abortion rights for women, you know, you see this, it often means much more than the normal harassment of women trying to get an abortion, which is, you know, you can see it in any city where there's abortion clinics. You can see the, you know, these Christian fascists come out and they try to stand in front of clinics or harass people, do all these things, or even the people who've threatened to do bodily harm and kill people for going in and trying to have an abortion or kill abortion doctors. Now, you've talked about this. In fact, there's been a recent situation with you. I remember when I last spoke to you, we were talking about your clinic that you had established in Germantown, Maryland. And then I read something where actually your clinic no longer exists. That particular clinic no longer exists in Germantown. It was recently forced to close as a result of the kind of stepped up assaults we're talking about. Tell people what's happened and what the impact of that is.
The issue in Germantown came from a small, I think a relatively small, one parish church and a organization called Kick Carhart out of Maryland. They were able to raise in 6 months over $1.6 million to buy the clinic from the present landlords and pay them a significant bonus in what the value of the clinic was. they had to sign that they would never participate in abortion clinic practice again, or what that was all part of this deal. But they sold it to the Maryland Coalition for Life, who, on the date of the purchase order being signed, or the contract, evicted us. That was also part of the negotiations. And so we had zero notice. In fact, I had worked Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday that week, flew home to Nebraska. When I landed in Nebraska in the morning on Thursday, there was an email to call, and I called the clinic manager, and she said, "We've been evicted, I'm locked out, and we can't get the records." We ended up even having to go into court to get the medical records out of the hands of the anti-choice people. I mean, the old owners had them, but they wouldn't release them to us because they didn't feel that that was what they were going to do. And our biggest worry was that they were going to be compromised and the patients compromised. We now have the records. We were able to win that court suit. But this is a small parish. This is one church and one small organization. We were able to raise $1.6 million in 6 months to close one clinic. Sorry, the owners had two clinics that they owned, but they bought one, and the other one they just had to step away from. It's crazy. You know, it's everything comes down. And this issue is like every other issue in life. It's time and money. And that's what we don't have. I mean, well, the women don't have time because their issues are critical. They have maybe 2 to 3 months from the time they find out they're pregnant until they can't have anything else done. So I don't know the issue. I just know what I think we need to do, and that's to train more doctors. I'd love to see first trimester abortions go back to OBGYN offices and be done by their primary care doctors. And I think there's need for specialty abortion clinics after that, because unless you do a lot of something in medicine, you probably shouldn't do any of it. So to keep abortion safe and legal, we're going to need clinics to take care of the women after the first trimester. That's where we are, and that's what I'm trying to do, is to train the docs to take care, or to even give them a chance to realize what the patients need. In medical schools in this country, the doctors are not exposed to patients that are in need of termination, so they never have any idea what the patients are going through. And that's one of the reasons that we've been working closely with some of the medical programs to have their docs just come in, sit and talk with the patients, understand why they're here, and understand that this is not a black and white issue. This is really, well, I guess it kind of is a black and white issue. It's the mother's decision of what this child is going to bring into her life. Either a lifetime of joy or a lifetime of disaster. And she's the only one that knows the answer to that issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, Lee, because one of the things I kept thinking about is there really is a special importance to, one, as you're saying, to independent abortion clinics and providers. And also this point of, you know, the kind of steamrolling move that was made against your clinic, that actually was very much tied up in your refusal to sort of accept a lot of the limitations, not just the outright banning of abortion or abortion rights, or the fact that over the last number of years there's been so many anti-abortion bills, it's just mind-boggling. But you've actually said that there was kind of a special significance to this forced shutdown, in that it was one of the few clinics in the country that provided abortion no matter what, no matter if it was a very beginning of a pregnancy or if it was a late term. If a woman needed it, you would give it to her. Let's talk about that a little, the importance of that.
Right now, there are three clinics that are noted. Well, we're willing to admit that we're doing the later abortions, and there are three docs that are in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there's one doctor in Boulder, and there's myself on the East Coast. Just the fact that you're willing to tell people that you're out there for them, it takes a serious amount of you know, deciding to give up your own personal safety and your own personal life. I mean, we know that we're going to be harassed if we tell the people that this is what we're doing. But the women also need to know that our services are available, because we had a patient just a couple weeks, right after we first opened here, 28 or 29 weeks pregnant with a baby that could not survive, that had been told at 24 weeks that there was nothing she could do. And it wasn't until the word about the closing of this clinic and the unavailability that hit the media that she went to her doctors and said, you can't tell me that there's nothing I can do. I need to find. And then she eventually found us on the internet. And at 29 weeks, she was able to take care of a problem that should have been taken care of at 24 or 25 weeks. You know, and so, you know, we can't blame women for choosing late abortions or late. I hate that definition because, as I said before, late term is the day after conception in some people's mind. But later gestation, advanced gestation abortions, they happen because of a myriad of problems. But I don't think one ever happened because, well, I've been pregnant for 28 weeks, but I think I don't want it anymore. That's not there.
That's a very important point, man, actually. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Lee Carhart. Lee has been providing abortion care for over 45 years and has been right in the middle of the assault on abortion and the fight to defend abortion rights and the humanity of women everywhere. One of the things, too, I wanted to ask you, and again, this gets into the importance of this of independent abortion clinics and providers. And that's something that you've always fought for, but also it's been both a matter of necessity, not just a question of will or feeling, you know, or sentiment, but it's extremely important that women are able to find clinics like what you're operating, what you're running, because it is, you know, it does come down to, and you can see it in the attacks that are coming, and it does come down to basically not just an assault on the rights of women, but an assault on, as you mentioned, the actual humanity of women and their ability to control their own bodies, do what they need to do, what they feel they have to do, you know, or they want to do. That's a big question here. And so I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
That brings up to my mind the thought about the crisis pregnancy centers, that issue. A very prominent person in the media I was with just recently, and her story was, at the age of 16, well, she lived in a rural area in the Midwest, one of these pregnancy centers for all information, and was given, when she got there, she was told that, well, congratulations, you're pregnant, here's all the information about having a baby. And she said, well, what if I don't want to have a baby? And she says, oh, well, you know, it's not legal in our realm, is the way she said it. It was not legal in the church or the sponsorship of the group, but she just said in our instead of in the United, you know, but in our state, it's not legal. And so she thought she was breaking the law. And then after being, she called it, badgered for about 35 or 40 minutes with all these anti-choice things, and she said, well, I'm going to have to go talk to somebody else about abortion. And she said, well, you know, abortion is murder. And so she looked at her again and thought about that. And then when she walked out the door, the lady said, well, if you choose to murder your child, you're going to be damned. And then these crisis pregnancy centers receive money from the government. In Nebraska, they get money from the tobacco fund. That all goes to the crisis pregnancy centers. They're all tax exempt. They don't participate in support of our society, yet they just present only one view and intentionally mislead and confuse women. And this is a college educated now. I mean, she was only 16 at the time, but she was not one of the less informed women in the world, you know. The government can't keep, well, it can, obviously. It's been doing it for 30 years now since Roe, but the government should not be enforcing one side of the issue. If they wanted to present both sides, I think that would be phenomenal. But just to say, to support and pay people to stand out and say abortion's not legal in the United States, or they didn't quite say that, but to infer that, and to call people murderers that are seeking really an important part of health care. And this one's gone on to be a very, very prominent member of society. And as she just told me, that if I hadn't done this, I'd probably be another role in statistics in the welfare plan to having a child at 16 and an abusive boyfriend.
You know, it's incredible because you think about this, too. It says when people are talking about this, it's not as though, you know, you made a point about sort of what this all is part of. And I kept thinking about, you know, when you watched, you know, people who watched The Handmaid's Tale, you know, on television this last year. And you think about what that reduces women to, where they're reduced to people who serve, or they're reduced to you know, not even sentient beings. They're allowed to walk around dressed like in an iron cloak and, you know, service sexually the master of the house. And it has everything that's tied up with this has to do with, you know, then the adulation of a woman who you're only worth something if you produce a baby for the regime and all this stuff. And you think about everything that's happening in relation to abortion has so much to do with the actual robbery of the humanity of women. I mean, it really is important. You mentioned that earlier, but I keep thinking, keep coming back to that. And I think that's one thing that's always stuck out in relation to your work, is that insisting on the humanity of the women who live in the world.
One of the things that got me into abortion in the first place to believe in abortion as a young person was the inherent inequality of parenting. You know, like the male partner in a relationship has the right to divorce, I mean the right to abort the child from the moment after conception until the kid is 16, 18 years old. All they do is walk out of the picture. Nothing's held against them. If they can track them down and if they have income, and if you can prevent them from changing jobs every week so that the courts can force them to pay the income, pay the support. But men have had this right of abortion and able to effect, just walk away from the pregnancy at any time. And I think to deny that from the mother is just inequality to start with. The mother has no more obligation in my heart and mind to the child than the father does. Well, I guess what I should say, the father has no less of an obligation to the rights and welfare of the child than the mother does. So until we can provide support, you know, I think it should be illegal to produce a child without the consent of the partner. I don't think that rape it's not the rape part, but they shouldn't be able to conceive either. I mean, to make it legal, to make it right, to make it fair. If a man causes a pregnancy, either intentionally or unintentionally, then I think he should have the same responsibility throughout the life of that child that the mother has.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about
until you can provide that, then I think there's no rational argument against abortion.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about the argument that's been made recently that says the abortion rate in this country has fallen to its lowest point since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, and since that legalized abortion? How do you read this? What do you think about this in terms of this point?
I think I read it as the abortion providers in this country are doing a good job. We're trying to educate women on birth control. We're trying to help them to prevent pregnancies. The morning after pill, the birth control developments that have came, all these things have came, and I think abortion doctors by far talk about future pregnancies and prevention of them to their patients than pretty much any of the even family practice docs. I mean, I'm sorry, even the family planning docs that are out there. I mean, we tell every patient, and this came from my training, is that my job is here, yes, to help you with this pregnancy, but B, to help you have a better life and not need to come back. And even if you get pregnant again, that's not a problem. But it not on your emotions, on your thoughts, on your mental health, and on your financial health, abortion is a big deal. So if we can prevent it, that's our primary mission, after we take care of the immediate problem. So I think we're doing a good job. I know the antis have made abortion less available so that women have to travel farther, and probably many babies are being born because of that very issue, just that the woman can't get an abortion. But I don't see a problem with the decline in abortion rates. I think that's a phenomenal statement that we're doing our job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. Now let's talk about this one last thing that people need to know. You're not shut down in Maryland. You actually did, in fact, rise up and start a whole new clinic. Tell people about that.
We were able to find a building, actually, that has about a third more space than the last clinic did. It was close enough that we could keep the same staff, so we lost nobody as far as the trained staff, and which is, you know, in any business, a good staff is the key to your success. It's not what you bring to it, but it's what you select and help find other people to train them to do to make it really a good issue. We have better hours. We're going to be able to provide service longer. I've had requests for people from doctors to come and be trained to start doing abortions, A, with us, and then look to the point of maybe branching out, opening another practice somewhere else in the country. So it's been a good thing. I hated for it to happen, but looking at the big picture, I think not only I, but the women in the United States have made an improvement in our lifestyle. I mean, we're able to take care of them. So I think it turned out to be a good thing.
Okay, great.
It was expensive, but as I said, money is the issue. So we were able to get it and move forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, great news, Lee. I want to ask you one other question, and then we'll see if we can fit this in. As we're talking about all this, I keep thinking about, yes, it's really important that we've come to this point where we're actually, able to say that you've been able to reestablish your clinic, that there's a fight going on that's not one-sided, that there is actually people coming forward to stand with women and with humanity, because that's what it is. It's the right of women to an abortion is a right, a human right. And one of the things that I found as I was reading and preparing for this, one of the things that I found is that in Ohio, they actually recently have tried to or did enact a heartbeat bill.
Yeah, Ohio and North Dakota has been playing with something very close to this also. In fact, I think theirs is in existence, but it's being challenged. Yeah, the Center for Reproductive Rights, it's a national legal organization that defends women's, they don't defend the women, but they defend the legal options that are given to women in the courts. And, this is essentially, as I said in the beginning, that late term is after conception. I mean, they just keep whittling away. Ohio has the 20-week ban. Indiana, with Mike Pence, passed this bill where if the baby has any deformity known, diagnosed, then if it's only 2 weeks after conception, you can't terminate that pregnancy. What it's doing exactly, the women from Ohio, I have 3 patients this Sunday that are coming from in Ohio and 1 from Indiana. So, it makes the travel farther. But, of course, their goals are to get this passed in the Midwest where it's easier to do these things to women. And then as they gain steam, they'll keep, like they are with the 20-week ban now, trying to get to the federal government level where it becomes a national law that if there's a heartbeat, you can't terminate a pregnancy. Is it constitutional? It's not even close to constitutional, but that doesn't mean the Supreme Court can't uphold it. I mean, it's just damaging. And again, it comes back to the very basic thing that until the women of this country are willing to stand up and fight for their rights, maybe they're too old to need abortions anymore, but their nieces and their nephews and their daughters and their offsprings of the future aren't. And I think, my brother was openly gay, and we've talked about this forever. And the reason for the gay rights movement to be where it is today is not because of where we started differently, because in 1972, we were both in the same place. Both women were badly beaten up, and the gay portion of the public were beaten up. But the difference is women are pregnant for 9 months, and they need an abortion in a window of about 8 or 10 weeks where it means everything. It's the end of the world. But after that, it goes away. But when you're gay for life, and you know what you need to fight for. But what we need to do now is convince the women not to only fight for it when they're pregnant and need an abortion, but they have to go on and establish themselves and demand their equality until everything gets to be normal for them.
Mm-hmm. All right, Lee. And I would add just one more thing. A whole lot of men got to get into that too, got to stand with women and take this up. Lee Carhart, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Take care, man. That was Dr. Leroy Carhart, a heroic abortion provider and one of the very few courageous doctors to provide late-term abortions. He has persevered in the face of legal obstacles and anti-women terror, including the murder of his friend and colleague, Dr. George Tiller. Dr. Carhart is waging a battle to defend and protect the right of all women to have access to abortion and the right for them to be full human beings, recognized as full human beings. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Sam Menefee-Leiby to talk about what's going on in D.C. and the Inauguration Day protesters.
Ha!
right, welcome back. And I know you know that song. It's the Isley Brothers with Fight the Power, all right? It's a great song, and I thought it was really what I was feeling this morning. All right, back, people remember a few weeks ago, I first spoke with Sam Menafee-Leiby of the Dead City Legal Posse talking about defending the Inauguration Day protesters and about his involvement in taking up the fight around that, all right? These are people who are facing 60 years in prison in a vengeful attack on the right to protest, and especially the right to protest against the Führer, okay? That's what it is, all right? That's what they're talking about, that these people are facing 60 years in jail for daring to stand up and fight against the Trump regime. And Sam is back to talk with us. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's jump into this because I want to get as much as possible. The trials have begun for 7 of the 230 defendants facing these 60-year sentences and 60 years in prisons for demonstrating, and demonstrating in particular at the Trump inauguration. And these are known collectively as the J20 defendants. What's going on now? Where are things at?
Yeah, so it's actually 6 defendants on trial. There were 7. One had their discovery changed at the last minute, and the U.S. Attorney's Office is actually alleging that they are a different person than they were originally identified as. So they opted for a later trial, and there are 6 people currently on trial. Your listeners may remember that back on Inauguration Day, there was an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march where folks were assaulted by police for over a half an hour. And eventually kettled and mass arrested, or 230 people were kettled and mass arrested. They were blanket charged with felony riot. A couple months later in April, there was a superseding indictment that added a bunch of different additional felony counts, incitement to riot, engaging in riot, conspiracy to riot, and 5 counts of property destruction charged under conspiracy liability. The judge finally, at the beginning of November, recognized the fact that the defense had, you know, identified right away, which is the fact that there is no actual felony charge for engaging or conspiracy to riot, and so it's reduced to misdemeanors. So now there are 194 people left. The vast majority are facing 6 felonies and 2 misdemeanors, and the first 6 are on trial this week. We just finished the 6th day of the jury trial.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this. So there isn't really any evidence at all of, basically something that would support a conspiracy to riot charge, though, right?
You know, I mean, the government is throwing a lot of stuff out there, and they're showing a lot of video, they're showing sort of messages taken off people's phones, and most of it is just planning a protest. So, you know, there's actually a video shown in court on Tuesday that was taken by the, you know, ultra-conservative right-wing propaganda outfit Project Veritas undercover. The U.S. Attorney's Office elected to show a 35-minute video that was taken by Veritas despite their long track record of deceptive and ethically dubious practices. And the U.S. Attorney's Office actually tried to hide the source of the video originally and tried to say that it was just from a citizen. But the defense was able to note that it was from Project Veritas. And, you know, it's a 35-minute video of a planning meeting of a protest. You know, there's lots of discussion of keeping safe and making sure that, you know, we are standing in solidarity with each other and that we're dedicated to anti-racist principles. And it's I think that folks were waiting for a big bombshell, and instead it was just a protest planning meeting that was, you know, then corroborated by an undercover police officer who we've learned a lot about the Metropolitan Police Department's intelligence gathering practices in this trial. And it turns out that they have a standard operating procedure for infiltrating what they call anti-establishment groups that are engaged in First Amendment activity. So it's been a very interesting week. So far, there's been a very, very little particularized evidence of any of the 6 people that are actually on trial. And most of the stuff that they're actually presenting is just, you know, video of that day and meetings that they'll plan to protest.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really got me, too, is that when they talk about this, the whole way that they painted this, I mean, it is true that this Veritas group actually has some kind of has a reputation, a well-deserved reputation as, oh, can we say what, pig? You know, this is sort of this
yeah.
is. Yeah. I mean, and it's something that is really out there. And actually, that combined with the prosecutor's constant references to what did they talk about? A sea of black masks. And so you get this thing, you know, let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, so you have the prosecutors at the Sea of Black Masks. There was also a very interesting testimony on Wednesday and Thursday from the commander of the Civil Disturbance Unit of the Metropolitan Police Department that day, Commander Keith DeVille. And he protested at length. He, I guess, commented at length about, you know, how proud he is of facilitating people's First Amendment rights. But then in the radio runs that they played, he repeatedly differentiates between protesters and anarchists. And he seems particularly preoccupied with anarchists. And it's very It was very telling to watch him sort of repeatedly testify that officers used restraint despite emptying multiple gallon pressurized cans of pepper spray from MK-46 pepper spray canisters, which are nicknamed by the police as super soakers, that they threw, you know, dozens of stinger grenades, which are, you know, have rubber cluster munitions and are sort of concussion grenades. It was really stunning to sort of see all of that and then have it sort of constantly come back to the cops just totally unabashedly talking about really profiling people.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Sam Menefee-Leiby from the Dead City Legal Posse on the current trial of the Inauguration Day, or J20, protesters who opposed the Trump inauguration and everything that went with it, the whole celebration of fascism. And these sisters and brothers are facing some heavy-duty charges and the possibility of spending decades, can we say 60 years, in jail if convicted. Tell me something now, just so people can be clear about this. Actually, this whole question about what they're doing with this Project Veritas and the filming and all this other stuff and the cop being present at the meeting and all this stuff is that they really are, they're laying the groundwork, it seems, to be pushing on a possible conspiracy charge straight up, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, the five property destruction charges, which are five of the six felony charges that folks are facing, you know, that's 50 of the 61-year potential sentence, are charged under conspiracy liability. And so, yeah, that is what they're pushing. And we're really learning a lot about how the Metropolitan Police Department apparently, you know, has a bunch of sort of standard operating procedures for actually going after and doing intelligence gathering on First Amendment activities, you know, surreptitiously through with undercover officers. It's very disturbing.
Yeah. And let's talk about this other thing that's been also very disturbing for anybody that reads about this. This precedent setting moves by the prosecution demanding names and email addresses of, are you ready for this, folks? 1.3 million people who visited the Inauguration Day protest website. And they've also been allowed to search Facebook messages, comments, and friends lists. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, so there's been, you know, a tremendous amount of overreach from the very beginning, that basically everything that's characterized the U.S. attorney's case has been about them sort of constantly asking for really just outrageously broad things. I mean, the legal theories are incredibly broad and scary. The sort of warrants that they've put out, they raided someone's house on the strength of apparently of that video that they showed in court. You know, and took just a bunch of stuff, including just a bunch of like innocuous things. You know, they took his anti-fascist flag because apparently having an anti-fascist flag is a bad thing. The search warrants, the digital search warrants, have been frightening. They were asking for IP addresses of folks who had visited disruptj20.org, because disruptj20 was the umbrella organization that facilitated a bunch of autonomous protests that day. But yeah, they're just sort of repeatedly asking for things that sort of shock the conscience of the average person. And we're really stunned that, you know, a number of judges have allowed them to do stuff like this over and over again, from the judge admitting the Veritas video as evidence to, you know, allowing these search warrants to go forth with only sort of minor changes.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about Alexei Wood, a journalist who's actually on trial as well, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. He's one of the six. So Alexei is a photojournalist who actually live streamed the whole march. So they're, you know, using his video as evidence. But he, you know, clearly didn't engage in any property destruction because he was live streaming himself the entire time. And they're, you know, charging him with conspiracy along with everyone else. So he and another journalist, Aaron Cantu, are still facing charges. Both of them are freelancers. And, you know, anyone who cares about press freedom should also be incredibly concerned about that.
Now, the other thing is, if I remember correctly, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I thought I remembered when we last spoke that, was it Alexei Wood's camera work, his films? Was that one of the things that they were trying to seize and use in a trial?
Yeah, so they did. They seized the camera and multiple SD cards, and I think it's actually creating more trouble for them than they were hoping, just because it has a bunch of his photojournalist work on it and a bunch of his sort of, you know, photographer for hire work on it. It sort of supports the fact that he was in fact there as a photographer and as a videographer. But yeah, they, you know, they seized all of his equipment and they're using the live stream video that he took against everyone.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the charges that they're pushing out, it's clear that the prosecutor is trying to build a conspiracy case. But basically, from what I've read of other people, you know, what other people said, from what you said, they really can't prove. They're not anywhere near proving any kind of conspiracy case, right? So what are they doing?
You know, I think that is a big question. I think that they are hoping to establish precedent for a lower standard for proving conspiracy. And they're hoping to basically say that presence, that, you know, that showing up to a protest that was publicly publicly advertised as a sort of, you know, anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march where, you know, folks should wear black, that, you know, if you showed up and wore black and stayed, you know, after some minor property destruction occurred, that you then were automatically a part of the conspiracy. The judge even has had several really sort of ominous rulings where, you know, was citing case law that apparently, like, conspiracy can be spontaneous and nonverbal. So they really are basically pushing that if you went to this protest and you stayed and you were still present after property destruction occurred, that then that means you become part of the conspiracy. It is terrifying.
And if you raised an eyebrow while you were there in the crowd, you can also be made part of the conspiracy, apparently, right? There you go.
I mean, they're also saying that, you know, people chanting is evidence of conspiracy, that, you know, that there really is. It's very frightening.
All right, Sam, you have a 1-minute wrap-up thing you want to tell people before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that's been notable about this is not just the case, but the anti-repression organizing that's been done around it. You know, my organization, the DC Legal Posse, has been around, but also Defend J20 Resistance has been great. You can find more information at defendj20resistance.org. And, you know, you can help donate money. You can sort of provide support for defendants. It's really incredibly important that as people experience repression by, you know, the police and the courts and prosecutors' offices and other repressive institutions.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I wanted to actually, my assistant producer over here has been telling me that all through this, he's been saying, the 1960s slogan, think about that. Conspiracy means to breathe together. Okay, so there you go.
Yeah, seriously.
All right, Sam, we'll stay in touch, and thanks for joining us today.
Okay.
All right, take care.
Thanks
now.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Sure,
okay,
bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sam Menefee-Libby of the Dead City Legal Posse about what's going on with the trial of the Inauguration Day protesters, all these people who are facing conspiracy charges and 50 years in prison in a vengeful attack on the right to protest. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That's Public Enemy with Eve of Destruction, their cover of Eve of Destruction. Now let's give a listen to Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from his recent talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We'll hear his response to a question about minorities and immigrants in the movement to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And although this speech happened a few weeks ago, it speaks directly to the outrageous decision of the Supreme Court to allow the Muslim ban to take full effect.
Since our minds are designed to stop us from doing anything that might hurt us, right? So minorities have been not in a very favorable situation in this country to fight for everything that, you know, that is going after them, not just Latinos, because they feel like they're not in the right place, they're not in the land where they originally come from. So they don't feel like they're in the position to fight for everything that is going after against them. So how can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly when they feel like they're not in a position to do that, because they will also be terrorized by saying, well, this is not your country, so how can we get them to be on the streets?
Okay, well, that's another important question. I mean, and it's a complicated, the situation is complicated. People, you know, as I was saying earlier, there are real consequences for people in standing up, even against their own oppression. There are real consequences. You know, it can always get worse. And people, you know, for example, who are undocumented, are very vulnerable now. And I think there are different levels to this. One, all these different outrages are things that everybody has to be outraged about, not just the people who are most directly affected. This is an important thing we have to struggle with. When, you know, as I said, you know, this idea that, well, maybe I can avoid the horrors happening to me and my loved ones and those I most care about is deadly, you know, and will be the death of any real movement that we need. So there needs to be a struggle with everybody, you know, and people have to learn that, you know, this is a subject of struggle too, that, you know, just because you don't get, you don't get immediate results doesn't mean you should stop. Like in this country, you know, in the recent decades, oh, by the way, I wanted to say one other thing I forgot to say about your question in the media. Just let me just say this before I forget. Social media, that's very important too. Let's get all over social media and break through in that way. I just wanted to, in addition to all the other things about the media that were raised. But, you know, people have to be, oriented that if something is important, you have to keep on struggling for it. You know, this is a land where we're conditioned for, you know, short attention spans and immediate gratification. You know, that's a problem that has to be struggled with. You know, and what am I referring to? Well, the original travel ban came out from Trump. And, you know, there was a really good response where thousands of people went to airports and protested. That was really good. But then people get worn down. You know, Trump didn't say, oh, well, people protest, so I guess I shouldn't have a travel ban. You know, he's determined to have this travel ban. So he keeps reshaping in different forms, and there's things go on in the courts, and he reshapes it. Now he's got another one, you know. And unfortunately, when he came out with a slightly, you know, altered version that didn't have everything bad that was in the first one, then there wasn't the same kind of outpouring that there was initially. Well, this is something that we have to break through on with people. That's the point about sustained resistance. So there were good sentiments, and there was a good outpouring of people who weren't directly involved. Overwhelmingly, people went to airports, were not Muslims or from the countries affected. The same thing has happened around DACA. The same thing has happened around deportations. People have protested, but it's not enough, you know, to protest once. This has to be sustained. You know, put it this way: if something was outrageous and you protest and it doesn't stop, it hasn't gotten less outrageous. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have to, you know, we have to win people that you have to keep, moving around this. But that's where the point comes in about if you don't drive out the regime, as important as different fronts of resistance are, you're just fighting ultimately a losing battle on all these different fronts because they have maintained the initiative and this regime is still in power. So you have to sustain the resistance, but it has to be, you know, geared and directed toward what will deal, you know, with all of this, because there's a whole package of things. I spoke to it in the very beginning of my, you know, remarks. There's a whole package of things they're doing all at once, and it does feel overwhelming to people. But, you know, we have to win people, you know, to see the need to, you know, to both sustain resistance, but more than that, and, you know, crucially, to actually direct all of that toward driving out this regime, beginning with, you know, November 4th, and moving and sustaining. Now, to go back to the question more directly about people who are vulnerable, I think that there's a two-pronged answer, or an answer on two levels. One is what I've been talking about. Other people have to get involved, and other people have to take this. We're not directly affected in this or that thing, including deportations. Have to take the stand that this is intolerable and we won't allow it. You know, that's one thing that has to happen. Look, as long as the regime's in power, you're not going to be able to win on that, you know. But you have to have that orientation. It's intolerable, and since it's intolerable, we're not just going to sit by and complain. We're actually going to, you know, have the stand that we're not going to allow it. The other thing is that the right tactics have to be developed so that people who are directly affected but have, you know, potentially high price to pay for getting involved can get involved. Because, you know, we can't, here's the problem, to put it really honestly. We cannot protect people from what the people in power are intending to do to them other than by driving out the people in power. If that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be measures taken to protect people tactically in certain situations. You know, a lot of creative, look, people are very creative. You see a lot of creativity whenever people are motivated about things. Sometimes really stupid things, but there's still a lot of creativity. Sometimes really important things. You know, even things that get made fun of. You know, like when they had the Women's March the day after the inauguration, all the pussy hats and stuff. There's a lot of creative stuff, you know, that people do. So the creative means should be developed to do the best we can to protect people who are particularly vulnerable to attack. But on the other hand, there is no cheap and easy way to deal with what we're confronted with. And we have to be honest with people about that. We have to bring forward the massive thing that'll drive out this regime and create a much more favorable political situation in this country, or real horrors are going to come down on people all over the world, including environmental destruction. I mean, look, sometimes I feel like this. You, adjective, expletive, people who voted for Trump, okay, you know, you want to vote for Trump. According to the rules of the system, you have a right to vote for, you know, whomever you want. You don't have a f***ing right to drag all of humanity down to oblivion. Yeah. You know, and this is... This is what we're dealing with here, and so there, you know, this is what we're confronted with, and there, you know, we have to do our best to protect each other, and not just in a narrow little small group way, but in thinking in terms of thousands and millions. But you know, I'm just going to tell the truth. This fight will not be won without sacrifice. You know, it would be great if it could be, but it can't be. And if we tell people a lie, we're just going to set them up for even worse things. We're going to have to sacrifice. I mean, you know, some of you may be familiar with the statement by this pastor Niemöller, who lived during the time of Hitler in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. And he, you know, he himself was persecuted, but he made this statement he made two statements. One of them people are more familiar with. He said, first they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the Jews, but I wasn't a Jew, so I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I wasn't a trade unionist, so I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was nobody there to stand up with me. But he also said, and look, I'm not saying these are the terms that we're confronting now, but he also said, if all of us who hated this had stood up at the beginning, maybe many of us, even thousands, would have had to die, but at least we would have prevented the horrors that were brought forth. Now, I'm not saying here, look, people's lives are precious. I'm not saying that, you know, sacrifice is an easy thing or talking about it lightly or anything like that. But if we recognize what we're dealing with, we also have to recognize that it's not going to be achieved without sacrifice. We should never give, you know, the people who are responsible for all these horrors any cheap victories. We should never allow them to have any cheap taking of people's lives or their freedom or anything like that. People are precious. People's freedom is precious, and we should understand and act accordingly. But we also have to recognize that, and this applies for all of us, we're going to have to sacrifice to deal with what we're dealing with. And that's just the plain truth. And people have to understand that. And people are capable of great heroism again when they understand two things. When they understand why it's necessary and when they feel that they are not acting all on their own and in isolation, but together with many other people who recognize and are standing up for the same thing.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from his recent talk, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." This film of Bob Avakian's recent speech addresses the most urgent questions of the day: how to understand and what to do about the threat to humanity itself that's posed by the Trump-Pence regime. It is an hour-long speech full of substance and heart. The entire speech, plus an extended question and answer period, is available at revcom.us. You can also find it on my Facebook page. And you can contact Refuse Fascism at refusefascism.org. You can email them at info@refusefascism.org or call 917-407-1286, and you can find a chapter in your area on the website. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Leroy Carhart, a heroic abortion provider, and Sam Menefee-Leiby from the Dead City Legal Posse. I also want to thank everyone who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. You can also find me on social media, on Twitter and Facebook as well. We're going to go out now real quick with "Sound the Alarm" from Thievery Corporation. Talk to you next weekend. Sound that alarm. We need it.